We've got Aaron Novak. Aaron is back on the attack. We have to go there. The elephant in the room. Why? Memphis, Egypt with Aaron and Todd. We know, as you said, it was time. Can you talk about that a little bit before we go on? Because I said, you know what? We'll wait till we get him on to press him on this. It was a great show for us. We kind of came into your radio show maybe in the later stages of it, in its final years, I guess, or at least with you as one of the hosts. So, you know, it was disappointing to hear, but, you know, you obviously had your reasons. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, making that transition from going to that and then from, well, I don't have that platform anymore. You know, I'm dying to talk about music. And hey, Todd, what are you doing tonight?
I know. Well, you know, it. I mean, our show really was, I guess, in a way, you know, a victim of the pandemic. I mean, that was the catalyst for the whole thing, because when the, you know, when it all started in March 2020, we were, you know, at that point, you know, all school, right? Colleges were completely shut down. And even when, so we could not go into, we could not access the studio any longer to do the show. So that really, you know, set us back quite a bit. And we had to figure out, you know, kind of how do we keep this going? So, you know, we started doing it virtually, right? And you know, we bought the equipment. I had, you know, mics, mixers, all that. You know, Todd and I would each be, you know, kind of doing it via Zoom. And, you know, it wasn't very spontaneous, because doing it that way, you kind of had to work out the whole playlist in advance, in a way. You were never actually playing the music. You know, part of the fun of the show for Todd and I is that we'd be hanging out in the studio, spinning some records, hanging out, sometimes having a beer that we stuck into the studio, chatting a lot during the sets while the records were spinning, and just having a good old time for, you know, a couple hours from 9 to 11 on a Tuesday night. But once we had to do it virtual, it really became a lot of work. You guys know how it is to, you know, produce a show. You know, with us, you know, you kind of want to organize yourself prior to doing a radio show. Hey, what am I going to play? You know, put some music together. It wasn't completely spontaneous, but then there's the post-production work, right? We had a website, we posted the show, you know, edited it, put the playlists up, all that. You know, it was enough work in and of itself. Once it became virtual, then all you're doing is putting puzzle pieces together. You know, Todd and I were talking and pretending that we just played the music. And, you know, that was okay as a stopgap measure.
We've done that.
Yeah. You just, you know, described, that's okay, our Christmas
for a little
show.
While, but it just lasted too long. And once we started to kind of, you know, sort of come out of the pandemic and things started to get back to normal and, you know, things were starting to open up, where we were doing the show at the University of Richmond here, you know, in Richmond, they were still quite conservative and didn't allow us still back into the studio. So even though students were allowed back in, we were still considered visitors.
I remember you talking about this the last time. This was kind of an issue.
Yeah. So, and so after a while, I just kind of, it kind of got to be a drag. It kind of got to be work. And then also too, you know, even when we had the ability to go back, because I kind of said, you know, told Todd I had enough, you know, just prior to them allowing us back in. Because, you know, doing a gig every single week, you know, you have to do it every Tuesday night. You have to, you know, I have to leave my house at 8:15, drive down there every single week, week after week, and then do all the work that's associated with it, you know, outside of that. And it just kind of got to be a bit much. And after 11 years, I was, you know, my man, I just kind of had enough, and it was just time to kind of, it was a good run, right? It was like, hey, you know, we did it. But once it's, you know, just, you're not digging on it anymore, just having fun, you know, that's when it's time to just, you know.
Were you guys running your own board and everything in there as well?
Yeah. We did everything. So we engineered our own show, and that was all fun, you know, taking calls and everything, and, sure, you know, people calling up and asking about what song you were playing, and that was always, you know.
I got one more question based off of what you were just saying. Was your format all vinyl Or were you pulling, you know, pulling CDs as well?
A mix. Okay. A real mix.
That's cool. Yeah.
We would play, you know, just depending on where we could access stuff. I'd bring in old records, a lot of times, you know, even, you know, CDs, or, you know, a lot of times we would just something that we didn't have, we didn't own. We would, you know, stream and grab it, you know, digitally off the internet.
So it was just you guys working everything. You weren't working with a separate, like a sound guy behind.
Pretty
much everything.
The WDCE studio does not have a production studio at all. So it's just the main broadcast studio. So even when I would have bands and people come in, they'd all have to kind of just really crowd around, you know, the desk and everything to play. And I just have to kind of direct microphones as best as I could. And it was really, you know, kind of low rent, but we, you know, we did the best we could. But yeah, it was, but you know, my enthusiasm for music has not waned a bit. And I'm always still, you know, looking to discover new bands. I'm out all the time at shows. I'm, you know, I walk every morning for about an hour and a half. I always have my earphones in. I'm listening to a couple albums every morning. Maybe it's something old I haven't listened to for a while or something new that I'm, you know, just want to check out. So the passion hasn't waned, but, you know, just being tied to a schedule, a weekly schedule, you know, I haven't really looked back. I really, no regrets. You know, it was a good run.
Good.
We still have all those shows digitally filed away. We did take the website down because it costs money.
Right. I'm figuring out what I want to do in order to preserve what we've done, like in some, like our little small archive of shows that we have. And yeah. You say 11 years. Wow. Are we both drinking orange juice?
Yes. Yeah. Vitamin C, baby.
All right. Is yours spiked though?
I'm smoking cigarettes and drinking a diet cherry Pepsi.
So, you know, when I think of 11 years that you've done this, I guess when I met you and became aware of your show, you were probably in the sixth year, maybe in the fifth or sixth year. Man, the fact that this is our sixth year, and I'm as tired, I believe I'm as tired as you are, because when it comes to the editing and the mixing and just listening to, well, Pat is a little bit louder than me, or I'm, you know, just something happens, or the fact that our music was never live. That if there was music, we had to go in there every time, especially the three or four Christmas shows that we did. And they were taking off the MP3s.
Get flagged for it.
That one year. And MP3s, right? And mixing it into the Audacity track. I mean, this is, talk about a no-budget podcast. I'm using the free software known as Audacity. We're throwing MP3s of YouTube videos as our music, and pretending that we just played the song for a 3-hour Christmas. But I got to tell you, one of the reasons I wanted you back is because you championed our show from day one. When we had a very small audience, you bailed us out that first time when we had some issues with YouTube. You know, you put our show up there on your platform, and people were able to hear that, you know, that 3-hour marathon that we did. And I busted my ass on that thing, cause I was kind of learning it as it was like growing pains that first year. What I wanted to get to in terms of with Aaron, and I guess the symbolic nature of Aaron being here again with that Christmas show, the funny thing about Aaron putting that up on their own platform is that what we did was kind of a cheap imitation of what Aaron and Todd were doing. And that was by design, man.
And we only did it once a year, though. But that was like our homage.
That's cool. Old cinematic clips in the background and between songs, have music playing behind us as we're talking. And you know, like I've heard, your show reminded me of the old Vin Scalzo shows that I used to have here on
and that back in 1993. Absolutely,
like the Idiot's Delight show.
Jim Monahan still does one on Sundays, all mixed up on DHA up here. Same thing, man. That same kind of format. It's just like he just said, the Vince Gelsa.
When you're growing up in the suburbs of New Jersey and you're not really hip to like what's underground yet, you know, you're still a teenager, you're late teens, early 20s, and you're listening to mainstream radio. Sunday nights, Idiot's Delight came on and it was like an introduction to a different world. You know, you've gone from listening to Judas Priest to hearing like Yola Tango, right. You know, so I credit that show with a lot of Dramarama and things like that in the late 80s that I had no chance of hearing in high school.
Right. That's because, we it was a couple hours of freeform radio sandwiched into, you know, mostly a week of AOR programming.
Right.
You know, and that's what we were spoon fed mostly, you know, growing up, listening to whether we were listening to Scott Muni or PLJ or whatever it was. But yeah, to have somebody like Vince Scalzo, because I wasn't really even hip to Jersey City station up there that I like. That's kind of free form, that's popular.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you.
I wouldn't even know it.
I'm drawing a blank at the moment. Anyway,
because like even later on, I guess in our as I got into my 20s and 30s, you're listening to like FUV, Fordham University,
right,
like which was 90.3 or 90.7, and it was pretty much the same thing, but that was their format. It wasn't a 2-hour show.
Yeah,
that again, growing up, that's what I had. Idiot's Delight. I guess it was like in the late 80s, early 90s. So that's what your show reminded me of.
And I think that's what we tried to be a little bit too. You know, I was definitely influenced by you know, Vin and what he was doing. You know, that's what I liked. And we wanted to play music that we liked. And that's kind of all it was, right?
That was it. And I took the same approach. And now we're going to do this once a year. As long as we're doing this, we're going to do this one show a year. And if we could get away with playing music, and that's what I did. I went and retrieved all this stuff from YouTube, you know, download the YouTube downloader and turning them to MP3s and trying not to get a virus in the process.
We had to come up with a list and send you the list. And what was the format going to be for that show? I got to rewind a little bit because we were asked by Aaron and Todd to do a Desert Island song. And I shocked you by using the Pink Floyd song Dogs, only just because of how long it was. And it's just, to me, it's a really great piece of music. But I also have told Mike recently that I've changed my stance on a Steely Dan record. And if I were to get asked that question now, it would probably be, I'd probably ask you to play Glamour Profession off of Gaucho. I think Gaucho has slowly become my favorite Steely Dan record. It's the one I'm listening to the most. I feel like they've just, what was that, like 1980, I guess? It was like their last like really mainstream record before Cousin Dupree. But they got it. They got where they wanted to go. And I felt like they were there because every song on the record is just so tightly spun. And every little noise coming from every little direction was meant to be there. And just Glamour Profession to me, man. It's just the lyrics in it are, you know, they speak for themselves. But the music on that track is, man. And I remember telling DeRico about it. I was like, you know, I have to change my favorite record by them. And this is, you know, I'm 52 years old now. And it's just all of a sudden out of the blue. But that would be my song now. I'm changing it.
That's your new Desert Island.
Yeah, that's the one.
Tune.
Before we started recording, you started talking a little bit about the Pearl Jam show.
Yeah.
Give us a rundown on, you know, how was the set list? How was the crowd? I know you were very close to see, you know, again, like close enough to see that Eddie Vedder is now morphing into
Norm McDonald.
Norm McDonald.
Yeah, I mean, I could have, you know, yeah, I could have reached out and like kind of grabbed his hand. That's how close we were. I have never seen the pavilion in Camden that filled. They were at max capacity. I should post some of those pictures. I didn't take a lot because I wanted to kind of really enjoy the show. I took like little 30-minute clips of them doing certain songs. But they started the night slow, which they've kind of been doing on this tour. They come out just really sitting down, and you know, they played like three or four slow numbers. My brother really wanted them to play Release, but they didn't. They had opened in New York City with that. No. So I kind of told him, I was like, I doubt you're going to get that, because it's very rare that they open up with the same thing. But I like the third or fourth song, though. They did Animal off the Versus record. And from there on out, it was just mayhem. They did a lot of material from 10, which I was surprised. Wow. We got a show where they only did maybe two or three tracks off the new record, which I do enjoy. Mm-hmm. I really do enjoy the record. But they did Breath and State of Love and Trust from the single soundtrack back to back. And then they did Leash after that. Those two back to back on them.
That's
in their own
great song.
Yeah. And in their own right, those two back to back, you're like, whoa, that's a nice little encore. And then Leash after that. And I mean, to hear
Leash is sick, man. That's just it, like, is. The fact that he's in his, like, what is he, late 50s, and he's still screaming, drop,
yeah, get out of my fucking face. And he means every word of it, you know. Yeah. But what's so cool is that they really get off on like that crowd singing back to him. And from the opening number, man, it just like when they were doing Daughter and all those little nuances that he throws into the crowd, that we all know him. And we're yelling him back at him, and he totally gets off on that. That one short video clip I got, he's like right in my face, and I got him just as he goes, "It's Evolution, baby," and I was like, "Oh, that's
I saw that
moment right there, man."
Yeah,
it was fantastic. I mean, like Mike said, these guys are older than me. I mean, they got to be 56, maybe 54, somewhere in that. They're not much older than me, but they're in that or us, we're all the same age.
I would definitely say they're at least a minimum of 5 years older than us,
and just still getting it done. Just I mean, they were tremendous. I might be biased because they're, you know, they're definitely a top five favorite band for me, but from the beginning to the end, it was a, you know, and I really tracked their set lists, and again, aside from that New York City show, that one on 9/11 at the Garden, they did a Mother Love Bone song, which they kind of debuted there many, many years ago. They did that again, and they had a show in the city. But that's the one show that was always on the tour when the tour got canceled during COVID. Like that record came out, that Gigaton came out
in April.
March
month,
or April
a
of
month
the,
into the pandemic
into the pandemic right
we had started our fourth season, and we were like two episodes in, and we started talking about it because it came out. I remember I was like, man, it's so cool to get excited about not just one new album but three, because the Strokes, Pearl Jam, and Fiona Apple records the same month. I was like, man, this is like Christmas and my birthday. You know?
I remember reviewing that record on one of our shows because I did like it that much. They did do, remember, I don't know if you remember, Mike, going back there, Quick Escape off of Gigaton, I thought was just a really, and sure enough, they played it, and it's that good live.
Did Eddie do anything off his solo record that he just recently put it out?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I mean, was there an opener?
No.
Did anybody open these shows?
They did. Paralorn or something like that.
Paramore, for real?
No, not Paramore. Let me look it up.
I'm not into Paramore, but they got a pretty respectable following,
right?
You know, like I wouldn't I guess I could see. Yeah, they would definitely open for Pearl Jam, but you would think that they're probably like headlining at least.
Pluralone.
Like, okay.
Pluralone. I heard them. I mean, I didn't go in until Pearl Jam came on. Because it was just in that pit. That pit holds about 350 people, and when they say 350, they're sandwiching 350 in there. I mean, you're ass to elbows with everybody in that pit.
Yeah.
But so we kind of hung out and were drinking beers and stuff like that out.
So what happens if you have to pee?
Yeah, you got to go out.
You got to go out and you get back in. So they'll let you back in, but you may not get your spot where you were. You may have to fight yourself back up front.
Got to fight your foot. Yeah, you got to fight your way back in.
Yeah.
But, you know, by that point, because we left, I think right when they started Even Flow, we kind of went out, used the bathroom, grabbed another drink. That we had a VIP access to this lounge area, had their own bathrooms. We didn't have to wait in line in the bathrooms. It was air conditioned in there. We could drink out there. We could, my brother and I both smoke, so we could have a cigarette. So we were out there for Even Flow and another song. Don't remember which one off the top of my head. And then when we came back in, we were kind of in a better, we weren't as close, but we were in a, just a better, like, free moving area. You know, you could flex a little bit if you wanted to.
Never been a fan of the pits, but like, I think about like the only two bands /artists that I would do that for, where I would fight my way up front, was Stereolab. I had to have my hands on the stage, man. And Patti Smith, you know, and like every Patti show, every Stereolab, I was on the, like, my arms were on the stage.
I rode the rail.
Like Dr. Marlow would always say, my arms were on the stage.
Funny enough, a month before the Pearl Jam show, I saw Counting Crows and Asbury, and I was riding the rail for that too. We got there super early, and that was right there. He's losing it a little bit. He's not where he used to be. You could tell. I mean, certain things he really did well. But like Mr. Jones, I think he's just kind of sold it in on that.
What stuck out? Is it, how much of August and everything after are they playing at this point?
They're doing a good.
Nice.
Songs like Omaha do really well still.
So let me ask you, Pat. So, I mean, obviously Pearl Jam, that was probably, was that a sold out show?
Yes.
But, and so how was the crowd for like Counting Crows, for instance, when you went to go see them?
Packed. I could not believe, my friend and I went to that show, and I was like, you know, I got to use the bathroom. We had to fight our way to the very back. Have you been to Summer Stage at Asbury Park?
I have.
So we had to fight from the stage all the way to the back where they're selling food, and like there's another exit back there. I could not believe how difficult it was to get from where we were to the back of that place. It was all like 40 and 50 somethings that grew up in the 90s and wanted to really sit there and listen to Mr. Jones. I don't even think August and Everything After is their best record, but everybody wanted to hear that stuff. But I was amazed at how crowded it actually was.
It's interesting because, what I'm seeing and what the industry's kind of seeing right now is a bit of an oversaturation. There's more supply and less demand right now. You know, it seems like, post pandemic, there's all the artists are out, right? And that's how they make money these days, right? They don't make money selling records or streaming music.
Right.
They make money touring and selling merch. So everybody's out there. And while I've gone to, a few of the shows that I've gone to recently were pretty full. But what I'm seeing in my market down here in Richmond is artists having a tough time selling tickets.
Wow.
So like my local record shop has tickets for all kinds of shows around town to give away. It's just that it seems that, I don't know if it's macroeconomic issues, a lot of people, just things cost a little bit more. And so they got to be a little bit more budget minded with their money and what shows they're going to go to. Or there's just so many artists on tour right now that, people just have to kind of pick and choose, and they're not, you take like a Jason Isbell, for instance, who, typically can readily sell out a 5,000 or 6,000 seat venue. Recently, he'll play a venue that was, a third full. And so it's interesting kind of what the dynamic right now that's happening, because everybody's trying to catch up from the pandemic. I know I'm trying to still catch up from the pandemic. I try to get out there as much as I can. I've been going to like shows like nonstop. Besides, you and I chatted a little bit, had a little bit back and forth that I had a little lull during the summer, but that's not because I didn't want to go. It's just, there wasn't a lot that interests me, that I wanted to go to. I mean, I got a bunch of shows. I went to like three shows in a week last week, and I'm going to a show Friday, and I'm going to go see Arcade Fire and Billy Strings, and I got on tap.
That's why I wasn't worried about topics. I figured, man, we could just go through like your last year and a half of concerts.
I have nothing coming up. I saw the Black Crowes. That was a birthday gift pre-pandemic, and finally got to see them, who were really just really lights out. It looked like those two were getting along, the brothers. The Pearl Jam show I had known about, that Counting Crows show just kind of popped up. I got dragged into going to see Kid Rock, and it turned into a Trump rally.
Oh, God.
I did go because some really good friends of mine you know, I'm one of those guys who I can try and be the life of the party. And sure enough, I did. I got really, really intoxicated and just had a good time. I just ignored all the other noise around me.
Right.
Those folks are pretty dangerous though.
Yeah.
So I guess like you said, I'm just like kind of picking and choosing, and I don't know.
Who did you say opened for Pearl Jam? Who was the artist again?
Floor Alone.
See, I'm not familiar. You're going to be sorry like 20 years from now when they're like, you know, headlining Madison Square Garden.
And I didn't go in.
And I had a chance to see them when they were just opening for Pearl Jam back in 2022. And I was hanging outside with my brother smoking cigarettes. I never went in. I always have to go see the opening act. I always make a point to go in.
I did take Riley to see her first club show at Starland Ballroom. I had bought tickets for Wolfgang Van Halen, and the band that he was opening for was Dirty Honey, who opened for the Black Crowes. And Dirty Honey, that right now is the band I'm listening to as far as new music goes. They're sloppy blues, Black Crowes, Zeppelin, Stones type. It's just really good. I totally dig it. It's nothing. They're not. It's nothing new. It's the same recycled kind of music, but they're okay. Just the attitude. So we walked out of there, Riley and I didn't bring earplugs, and I couldn't hear. Wolfgang Van Halen might be the loudest musician on the planet Earth. He takes that from his father, I guess.
Wow.
I couldn't hear a thing for like a day. So she had a blast and has her first rock and roll star crush on the bass player from Dirty Honey. So she's watching this guy because we were kind of close. And he's a lefty and he's just wailing away. So I'm looking at him. I got dad arms like this. And for those of you who are listening, I got my arms crossed in front of me. I'm looking at him. I'm looking at her. I'm looking at him. I'm looking at her. I had that little bit of, no, you're not getting involved with a rock star kind of moment there.
That's funny. Now, I'm always about, like, you know, I just always love to go see, you know, like, you know, the opening act. You usually see somebody, right? It's somebody you never heard of.
Yeah.
And it's some up and coming band just kind of putting themselves out there, doing their art, doing their thing, trying to find their way. Sometimes it's just terrible, right? It's just like, oh my God, when, you know, you're just looking, when's this 45 minutes going to be up, yeah. You know? But, you know, I went to see Snail Mail at, the National is one of the venues here in Richmond that I go to often. And there was three acts, and the middle act was this band called Mama. It was, you know, a weird name, I absolutely fell in love with them. Immediately, this made me think of the Breeders, like our Veruca Salt. Wow. You know, just front, it's a great band fronted by, you know, two female vocalists, guitarists. And, you know, I've been listening to their record. It's called Household Name. It's, you know, been a favorite of mine recently. So I've been listening to that a lot. I bought their record and everything. So, but you just never know, you know, you just never know who you're going to, you know, who they might turn out to be. I remember, like, for instance, I'm going to go see Pokey LaFarge on Friday night. Now, do you guys know Pokey LaFarge? He's kind of like old timey music. I mean, not Hokey Carmichael old timey, but, you know, he's got an old.
Did you ever post anything about him or something by him?
I probably have. I've seen him a couple times now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to see him at this place called the Tin Pan. It's kind of like a supper club, kind of like a Club Binet vibe.
Right.
Except that it's not just beef or chicken. I think they have a little bit more of a varied menu before the show.
And they don't have Kyle and his bouncers floating around.
No.
Kyle. Fucking Kyle.
But, you know, but the first time I saw Pokey LaFarge, I was in Nashville at the Mercy Lounge there. And one of the opening acts at the time was this band. It was Margot and the Price Tags.
I know that.
Yeah, well, you do, because now she's Margot Price, who's like one of the hotter names in country music these days. She was on Willie Nelson's Outlaw tour last year and such. And she's, you know, her sexuality is a little bit more out front than it used to be. Because then, you know, when I saw her then as Margot and the Price Tag, she was wearing this old school, like Loretta Lynn, you know, 1948, you know, ballroom gown type of outfit. That was kind of her vibe and stuff. And now, you know, and then she came out on Third Man Records, Jack White's record label, and, you know, kind of, you know, blew up. And so she's one of the big names in country music these days. But yeah, you just never, you never know who, you know, you might, you know.
See,
might.
This is good stuff, man. Like, even Jack White's label, how's that label doing? How are the artists that are on there? Do you stay in touch with that?
Well, you know, he's a great proponent of new artists, right? And I mean, I really love his new records. Really good too.
He's pretty.
What the hell is it called?
I don't know.
Embracing the name of it. Heaven Alive, or no? Yeah. Entering Heaven Alive is his new record.
It's good. I agree with you.
It's really good. It's a little. It's not the heavy electric guitar, you know, high pitched Jack White loud voice. It's a little bit more like, it's, you know, I'd almost want to say it's like his sea change, like Beck's sea change, you know, where, you know, it's more acoustic. It's a very acoustic record. But he doesn't seem to have, doesn't seem like he's going through any kind of heartbreak.
I was going
to
say, did he get married? Now that's his divorce album.
Yeah, no, it seems just the antithesis of that. He seems like he's in a very good headspace and very happy with his relationships and stuff. You know, and you know, that being said, it's still a good record.
Sometimes I think artists get divorced just so they could write their Blood on the Tracks album.
Exactly.
You know, every artist has to have their blood on the tracks.
Jack White is super underrated. He was super underrated by me early on. And a friend of mine I used to work with, he's like, nah, he goes, you got to give that another chance. And I'm like, yeah, I come back to him. I was like, hey, Josh, you're right. That's pretty goddamn good. He's pretty amazing guy.
He's a great performer. And I always love stopping in Third Man Records in a shop when I'm down in Nashville. So I do that pretty often. And I will buy music there that I haven't heard before. Something that might just look interesting. I'll take a chance and maybe buy a couple of records while
I'm there. So they go out of their way to find that stuff and put it in their store?
Yeah, so his store is strictly his label. Records for sale in the Third Man shop are Third Man artists.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And at this point now, it's a pretty deep
catalog. He's got a good stable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a band called The Walking Papers that opened up. My cousin brought me to see Miles Kennedy, who sings on the Slash record. He sings with Alter Bridge. So we were there to see him really in Asbury Park at the Asbury Lanes. And the band that opened up for him, The Walking Papers, blew him off the stage. And and the singer came out and was at the merch table. And I just started bullshitting when talking like we are. And it was just like you just said, man, it was just a great night of like a band that I never would have known anything about unless I had gone in. And I probably wouldn't have gone in if it was because it was pouring rain in Asbury that night. I mean, pouring rain. And right next door to the Asbury Lanes is Danny Clinch's photo studio. So we were there hanging out and there was like a small little band thing going on. Some of the guys from Blind Melon were there and we walked, I mean, literally just walked next door and got soaking wet. So I was like, let's just go in. I'm not going to hang around outside. And fortunately for us, we did.
I'll tell you what the most unusual opening act that I've ever seen is, and she's huge right now. She's a major star. So in 2015, I went to go see My Morning Jacket at an outdoor pavilion out in Charlottesville, about an hour and a half from here. You know, University of Virginia's out there and such. And Lizzo opened
really?
Up for My Morning Jacket.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was just like, you know, when I saw, I'm just like, what the heck is this? You know, it's just, you know, it didn't make any sense to me. It didn't seem, you know, they didn't seem connected at all. She was, you know, just, you know, as you know Lizzo to be, she was, you know, she a big, bold, you know, personality.
Presence. Yeah.
And she was out there doing her thing. And I, you know, I didn't know what Jim James, you know, I don't know, you know, it's just like, this is crazy. But so I can say now I've been to a Lizzo show.
I saw them open for Pearl Jam, My Morning Jacket.
So did I.
Yeah, that was my first
time. I've been to that show. At the, you know, Brendan Byrne Continental, yeah, whatever you call
it. We were at the same show. Yeah, How about that shit, man?
Yeah.
That was almost as unusual as Kanye opening for the Stones.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just like, what?
You know who got a lot of flack? Alice in Chains. Who took them out? It might have been like Megadeth, like a heavier band, like one of the real heavy bands. It might have been like a trio. I don't know if it was Overkill, Megadeth, Anthrax, Megadeth. Like, Alice in Chains didn't belong on that tour. And they went out and just fucking killed it every night.
Was it early in their history?
Oh, yeah. It was like their first record.
Probably why. Because they didn't know that this was something. Because I think a lot of those, my earliest memories of what became known as grunge Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden. They were treated as metal bands, if you remember. They were treated as metal bands in their earliest stages, right? Yeah. So it was, you know, a lot of them were featured on the Headbangers Ball.
But
and
you know,
this perception that they were an extension of metal, and then it just became its own thing, and they wanted to associate more with punk, and then grunge became grunge, and then the metalheads end up hating it. You know, that was just my perception of it, but that might be the case with why they were out there on that tour.
Yeah, I mean, and they took shit every night. And I can't remember who the interview was. It might have been Scott Ian, who was just saying, he goes, man, they just ate shit every night and just kept going out every night and doing their thing. Now, a band like Soundgarden, I could see pulling that off. They were a little more heavier and had some, like, I think, to me at least, some more like a Black Sabbath route to their,
yeah,
to their first two, yeah, records.
You know what, but I think it is too? I think it was all in a guitar tone.
Yeah, fair.
It was, you know, it was a lot of that crunchy, compressed, distorted guitar. And then it, a lot of it, especially maybe with Soundgarden, carried over into the drops D note, where like everybody started playing in drop D. You would see that with, like, you know, new metal,
right?
You know, like NU, like, and stuff like those groups.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mike, because I remember also, I was just thinking of another unusual pairing. In my last year at Rutgers in 88, the Godfathers were playing at the Livingston Student Center, like in a room, you know, and Living Color opened up.
Wow.
But again, it's that same, like,
the, you know, Godfathers, there was like birth, school, work, death or something like,
yes,
that.
Exactly. I remember that.
Living,
you know,
Color.
Here, you know, we got, and we're just standing around in a room, you know, and Vernon Reed, you know, playing, like, and then, you know, I had never heard of Living Color before, you know,
yeah,
before, at that point. I was,
you,
like,
didn't know where they belong.
Crap, this is, yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
You know,
to hear that guy play guitar.
They still complimented each other in a way, you know, basically, it's just because they had that heavy guitar sound, you know.
Living Color kind of like were straddling. Look, Living Color, the best way to describe Living Color in 89, when that first album really broke, Livid, it was called. Was,
yeah,
it Lit?
Yeah.
Livid. Yeah.
No, Lit. It was.
Yeah, okay. Livid.
Or Vivid or Livid?
Vivid.
Vivid. Vivid.
Vivid. Livid, Vivid. What's the vowel? Let me buy a consonant.
You would see them on the Headbangers Ball.
Right.
And then the next night, you'd see them on 120 Minutes.
With Matt, right. Yeah.
Right?
They didn't know where to put them. They had no
exactly
idea where to put them.
And then, then they were opening for the Stones at Shea Stadium.
I mean, you go back to the day. Could you imagine going to see Black Sabbath and Van Halen as the opener? I mean, that's, you know, that's when, like, you know, if I was out in the parking lot drinking beers while Van Halen just blew Black Sabbath off the stage, I would have been upset.
Right.
We're all, you know, we come full circle on that point.
Well,
sure.
Yeah, I think it was pertaining to what you were saying about Counting Crows, where Aaron had asked you about the audience, the crowd, if it was packed, and there's all these people that are our age there, and, you know, people in their 50s now, and some people that are younger if you got kids. But the 90s generation, Generation X, us, are now in that stage where the baby boomers were when the Stones were doing Steel Wheels and Voodoo Lounge. You know what, yeah, I mean? We're like 20, 25 years ago, where everybody, you know, all these bands that are in their 70s now, and they're kind of like, this is it. You know, this is like their retirement plan, the retirement tour, whatever it is.
Right.
Social Security.
And so
tour.
This generation now has got that we're kind of in our nostalgia phase, where it's just kind of like, these are now all these acts.
We just got to hope they keep doing it. You know, it's funny. My brother brought up, because the hot rumor is that Pearl Jam is going to release a new record next year and tour it. He has an electric car, so it wouldn't even cost us anything other than a hotel room wherever city we end up. But he goes to me, this is, my brother and I have only been to two concerts in our entire life.
So now it's two, right?
No,
because
yeah,
you were saying like this is his
it was
first
one.
Yeah.
But we had remembered, we went to see Hall & Oates when we were kids with my mom at Liberty State Park. But then we went to see Cinderella and Bon Jovi on New Year's Eve at the Meadowlands, I guess it was. And those are the only two concerts that we had ever gone to. So he was all amped up for this and just had a blast.
Was that the Earth Day Festival? The Hall & Oates thing at Liberty State
Yeah,
Park?
Yeah, it was like right after Madonna. it was like right at the night after Madonna played the Garden for the Like a Virgin tour. It was crazy. It was like 84. And Hall & Oates were firing. They were firing on all cylinders at that point. It was them, Gary U.S. Bonds, Till Tuesday. It was just a really good show.
The Big Bam Boom Tour.
Yeah, it was the Big Bam Boom. That's exactly what it was. Yeah. So he comes to me. He goes, I think we should drive around and follow him like the dead. I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind, bro. I was like, I'm 52. He goes, let's just start saving now, bro.
He's Hall & Oates?
No, not Hall & Oates. Daryl Hall can't get it done anymore. I'm sorry.
Oatheads. You're not deadheads. You're Oatheads.
Oatheads. Yeah. We're jammers. Yeah, I watched live from Daryl's house. He just can't hit those notes anymore. And I hate when he tries. He tries sometimes too much. I do like the experiences that he has with other musicians and jamming other people's songs and stuff like that, but you know, he can't do Sarah Smile anymore. Those days have passed. So I guess we're going to follow we're going to follow Pearl Jam around, I guess. I don't know. We'll see what my brother says.
How's the response to the new material?
Good.
Yeah.
Everybody knew it. In all fairness, they've had a long time to get to know it. Because that record came out in 2020 and here it is 2022. But you know me, I took to it like a moth to a flame. I liked it a lot. I was picking cuts out. I was like, this is going to be a great live number. This is going to be a great live number.
There are still a few artists that can pull that off because, you know, like my point before where our generation has become like an old, you know, like oldies act where you see a lot of bands that get criticized. Like, and I always say the Stones because the Stones, again, I think have become the template for everything in music. Like they're, you know, we gauge everything that we can do according to if the Stones have done it, namely number one, since I guess they always say, well, Tattoo You is maybe the last Stones album that anybody gave a crap about. So, you know, the joke is always, all right, the Stones got a new album. Here they come again. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about a bigger bang. Nobody cared about Bridges to Babylon. And it seems that there are quite a few bands that of our generation that continue to put new music out. And a lot of people don't seem to care about it, but there are artists like Pearl Jam where people do look forward to new music. You know, it seems like every time Metallica puts out a new record, they get crucified just for doing it.
Yeah.
You know, never mind what it sounds like, just for doing it. You know, I don't want to hear Master of Puppets, man. Come on, make me feel like I did when I'm in the football game in 1986, man.
In all fairness, though, Saint Anger is fucking horrible.
Well, I haven't heard anything good said about any of their albums since Load, man. They've been getting hammered just for releasing new material ever since the 90s, man.
You know,
they got crucified for Load. They got crucified for Reload. They got crucified for the thing they did with Lou Reed.
That was horrible, too.
You know, Death Magnetic, they were crucified for.
I feel, though, like Rush kind of fell into that, too. Later Rush, people didn't want to hear new Rush albums, but I did. I'm like, no, you're wrong. I mean,
yeah, I do know a few Rush fans that would say the same thing.
Yeah, you could pluck some good stuff off of some of those records. I mean, were they the 2112s of the Rush's career? No. But what's Rush going to do? Continue to put out a record every 2 or 3 years that is exactly like 2112? Admittedly, I was very hesitant about the Pearl Jam record because of the first two tracks that they released. What was the Dance of... I can't even think
of... Dancing on a Volcano or something like
that? No, Dance of something.
D-O-C, oh, wait, that's the New York Dolls.
Dance of the Clairvoyance, which I wasn't too crazy about, grew on me hard. Super Blood Wolf Moon was another one. I was like, but it grew on me.
It's interesting. And I guess, you know, kind of circling back to Dylan, you know, Dylan's definitely one of the exceptions to that rule, right? Yep. I mean, a new Dylan album still to this day, you know, or, you know, one that has come out within the last couple of years is just, you know, welcomed and most often, you know, critically acclaimed and a welcome piece of work.
And he's still blowing minds.
Yeah.
He's still making us say.
And admittedly, and I'm not as huge fan as you guys are of him, but I mean, the brilliance of the man, I have a respect for him that I have probably more than, you know, I mean, he's written incredible music.
And then when you go see him, it's, you know, it's something that he can perform, you know, because it's in his, you know, seasoned voice.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
So it's not something that he's trying to replicate that he, you know, did 45 years ago.
That's where the Count of Crows fell in. Like Mr. Jones was 30 something years ago, or 30 years ago, and he really can't get there. So he kind of just ad-libs his way through it. Some of the newer stuff is in his wheelhouse now, and he had no problem getting through that. Adam is who I'm talking about. He had no problem getting through some of that. Even some of the stuff off of, what album is that? Hard Candy. He had a really easy time getting through some of that stuff too. But, you know, Mike, what I was going to ask you about the Stones thing, their catalog is just immense. They could go out on a tour and play anything from any decade at any moment. Okay, we're going out on tour. Let's rehearse these 40 songs. And then any given night, we can play whatever. But my question is, if all four Beatles were alive, do you think that they would still be doing what the Stones are doing? And that's regularly touring, and they wouldn't be, right?
Yeah, I think the Beatles would have gone out, but not, they wouldn't, it wouldn't be a regular thing like the Stones. I don't know. I tend to not think so. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, I mean, they broke up.
There is that.
I think we're dealing with many more complicated personalities in the Beatles than in the Stones. I think Mick and Keith's relationship to the music and the idea of the Stones is much more conducive to an ongoing situation than Harrison's was to an ongoing situation, especially being in the Beatles, you know, being tied to Paul.
You know, and it's really, you know, and you know, let's be mindful, it's still, it's just Mick and Keith right out of the original lineup.
Right.
That's out there. I mean,
right.
You know, yeah, true.
They've gone on without Bill, but you know, after Charlie's passing, you know, yeah. And Ron's still, you know, he's still this new kid on the block 45 years in. So,
yeah.
You know.
No, I agree with you, Mike. I didn't think that they would have done it. Would, I mean, they certainly would have done something had they all lived. I firmly believe that.
I definitely think so. I definitely think they would have gotten together for at least once, maybe several times over the last 40, 50, 40 years since, you know, John was gone, you know. And
let's be honest, some of them didn't squirrel their money away like others did. So, I mean, getting paid that kind of money, I mean, people were going to throw a massive amount of money at them to see the Beatles tour.
You may have seen something happen at Live Aid, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. You know,
I didn't even think of that.
There was a period in 1989, and I use 1989 as that dividing line between, you know, rock's first unit or the first section before the next 25 years happened, where that generation, the baby boom generation, second generation of rock, whatever you want to call it, where they became oldies acts. Mm. Not so much, you know, I hate that term. I hate, what do they call those? This boils my blood even more. It's a fucking, what do they call it? Help me with this. Legacy acts.
Like, yeah.
Right. You've okay. heard that before. Legacy.
Yeah.
Acts,
yeah.
Right. I hate that. But it was when the Stones did Steel Wheels and went on that massive stadium tour, and the Who came back after 7 years and they did their 25th anniversary Kids Are All Right tour in massive stadiums. And Paul McCartney came back for the first time in many years and he did his tour, and Ringo Starr's All Stars came out, and Neil Young came back with Freedom, you know, his first rock, real rock album since Russ Never Sleeps. Lou Reed came back with New York. Bob Dylan came back with Oh Mercy.
Mercy.
All of these great 60s artists that had sucked their way through the 80s came back with these big comebacks, and they were here to stay, man. And they just became these legendary acts that went through the 90s, right? And they just stayed on that plateau ever since. And they just got older and older and older, and they're all pretty much still doing it, right?
They're still good at what they do.
That was kind of the dividing line, right?
Yeah.
So I don't remember what the question was, but
I don't even think it was a question anymore.
Yeah, but I don't remember what my point was, but
you got there.
You asked me.
You know, it's interesting. So, Mike, so a question for you. So you mentioned like 1989 as a demarcation line in the, you know, overall history of rock and roll, so to speak, right?
I consider it the middle.
What would you consider the starting point of the era before 1989? Do you define that at all? And I'm asking for a reason.
Well, I mean, the obvious thing is to say 54, but we could also say like 65.
Okay, so here I have something for you. So I have a book recommendation for you guys that I think both of you guys will like. So my buddy Henry, that you guys kind of know, he turned me on to a British music journalist, David Hepworth. So I've been reading a bunch of David Hepworth books. He wrote a book called How the LP Have Saved Our Lives. And then I read another one. And then he wrote this one here called Never a Dull Moment.
71. Yeah, I saw that
book. The year that rock exploded, 1971.
Right.
And he kind of, you know, makes the case that, you know, the early 70s, and he kind of picks on 1971, is like the most energetic and creative period in all of rock history. You know, it was like the end of the pop era and the beginning of the rock era. It was the end of the singles period and the beginning of, you know, albums. And if you think about, you know, 1971 and what was released that year and what was happening that year is absolutely amazing. So, of course, like, you know, we were talking about the Beatles before, and, you know, the Beatles bring up, of course, it was like New Year's Eve 1970 that Paul McCartney, you know, filed his lawsuit against Alan Klein and the Beatles to officially dissolve the Beatles, right? So we're now the official post-Beatles period. But if you think about everything that came out in 1971, I mean, you can go on and on, whether it's Elton John's Madman Across the Water, you know, Led Zeppelin 4, you know, artists like Carole King released Tapestry, Marvin Gaye released What's Going On, right? What else? I mean, it was the year that the revolution would not be televised, you know, with Gil Scott-Heron. One of the best rock records of all time, Who's Next, was released that year,
Zeppelin,
right?
Four, Sticky Fingers, Aqualung.
Sticky Fingers, Fragile. Aqualung, right. Ram was released that year. Pink Floyd, where it's no longer a psychedelic band, Metal was released that year. You know?
There's such a great argument to be made for 1971.
Yeah, so it was just, I mean, I know you're always busy writing, but I mean, I think you guys would love that book, because when I was reading it, I was kind of, it made me think of the whole, you know, original premise of the Rock Under Fire podcast and the whole, you know, and you know, what was the catalyst for the whole, you know, podcast to get started 6 years ago. And so anyway, just something I wanted to throw out there while we were chatting. I mean, it was the year, you know, there was a bit of a downsize too, right? Because we talked a little bit about Freeform Radio to AOR, because it was really, you know, big when, you know, that's when AOR really started taking over. PLJ went from Freeform to AOR in 1971, you know? Yeah. So, it's the year then the captain left the Beach Boys and joined Tennille for Captain and Tennille. I
mean,
you know,
conservatives railing against rock and roll from the moment Elvis went on Ed Sullivan, man, they were wagging their finger at Elvis, their finger at the Beatles for saying they were bigger than Jesus. Kiss, Knights and Satan Service. Yeah. They went after Elvis. They went after Ozzy. They went after the Dixie Chicks, man. So, you know, rock's been under fire from day one, man. And that's been the premise of the podcast. You know, rock's been under fire from various different entities. Rock's under fire from itself these days, man.
True. You know, but this was rock at its peak, 1971. Yes,
and a real great argument can be made. Sometimes, I don't know. I don't know if we could pinpoint one great year, but that certainly, they certainly make a good.
If you kind of think of it objectively, that's certainly a good one. I mean, because, you know, when you look back, you know, because right, music's all subjective and what you like. And a lot of times, you know, your favorite year is probably, well, one of your formative years. You know, I graduated high school in 84, and I think of that period. And, you know, I was a new wave kid growing up, and that's what I love. You know, Talking Heads, it was the end of the Clash, but it was, you know, beginning of, you know, the Smiths and Tears from Fears. And I loved all that music. And that's, you know, I think of those years as being terrific, you know, years for, you know, rock music still, you know, we still consider it rock music.
Have either of you guys heard the cover of, you mentioned Madman Across the Water. Have you heard that Brandi Carlile cover of that?
I have not.
She did it on the Howard Stern show.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Look that up on YouTube. I promise you will not be disappointed. That is like one of my favorite Elton John songs. And she it's haunting. It's so good.
I haven't heard it, but have you ever heard the alternate take of that with Mick Ronson on guitar?
No.
Oh man. That's the version I wish. When you hear that, you're gonna be like, fuck, why didn't he put this on the record?
Wow.
Why didn't he put this on the record? It's like, yeah, just listen to it.
And
Brandi Carlile.
Brandi Carlile, who I saw on Saturday Night Live, and I'm just blown away by her. I think she's really come into her own, and got me. Like, I was listening to it at work, like when I'm cleaning some of the stuff up in the shelter, I throw like a record on or something like that, and I was like, I'm gonna try this Brandi Carlile record, and it was not long after I found that.
Home.
What's that?
She got Joni Mitchell to leave the house.
Yeah.